This is the Rain Report. Lou McCoy, W1ICP, became a silent key July 31, 2000. His contributions to amateur radio were many. Prolific writer, avid DXer, father of the first national two-meter repeater band plan, and more. If you operate the HF ham bands today, those below 30 megahertz, you're probably using one of Lou's most notable contributions, an antenna tuner, or a modified version of his Ultimate Transmatch.
The Ultimate Transmatch came about from, I got an RCA paper that showed, I was matching from a plate circuit of one thing to the grid of a next stage, and they used a combination of a pi or a T that you could use two capacitors and an inductor to do that. But a very old friend of mine, W1QV, Bob Chapman, who had been head of Underwater Sound, lived down in New London, he told me, he says, why don't you do this and make it into an antenna tuner? So I played around with it, and I came up with a circuit, and then another ham suggested a variable inductor in that, and when I put it all together, the thing wound up with a circuit that would match almost any kind of a load you had out there. And I called it the Ultimate Transmatch because it would match anything, and I could do balanced or unbalanced. The basic circuit is not used anymore, but it's an offshoot of that, and everybody gives me credit for it, all the transmatches that are made today. When I came up with the 50-ohmer, which was a thing to match coax to out of your transmitter to a 50-ohm antenna, George Grammer and I were sitting in his office, and he said, I don't like the word antenna tuner because you're not tuning an antenna. I mean, you're coupling a load. He said, we need another name. And we fooled around. We came up with the word transmatch. In other words, matching the transmitter to the system. So we just coined it as a word, and it became a name. Do I use a transmatch? And my answer is always yes. And the only reason I do is because all the equipment today is designed to work into a 50-ohm load. The only way, really, you can get a 50-ohm load and be multi-band and jumping around and everything else is to use a transmatch. So my transmitter and receiver is always looking at 50 ohms.
Would you rather use a transmatch than use a trapped dipole? Aren't they both compromises?
Yes. No, I don't like traps. No, that's another long story. The original trap antenna was designed by a fellow named Ed Buchanan. This call was W3DZZ. He described this in March, I think it was, of 1953, QST. And I may be wrong on that month, but I think the year is right. And he described a trap dipole and a trap beam. Believe it or not, and I know this is a fact, the only good trap beam ever made was the one he designed. ever since then, they've all been compromises and so forth. But even that is a compromise, and he said at the time that this is a compromised antenna. He didn't know how bad a compromise it was, but we've measured trap antennas. I've been on ranges that they've done a good job in checking them. While it's a compromise to get on other bands, and the antenna does have front to back and front to side and all that sort of stuff, they just says lousy gain, and I don't like them. I mean, there's other ways of doing the job, and that's what I use.
Let's talk about how you got involved with the original, still current, 2-meter FM band plan.
Well, when repeaters first started up, and there's been arguments as to who had the first one, whether it was, I'm trying to think of the fellow's name out in California, and I believe he was the first one, and then there was a group up in Massachusetts that put up a station on a mountain there. The story on repeaters, and it's I know this is accurate, this fellow in California built a remote station from his own home station up on a mountaintop on VHF, 2 meters and so on. And he operated that station controlled it from down in his station. And he called it a remote base. And that term never has existed in electronics as far as the government's concerned. They could call it a remotely controlled station, but they, I'm trying to think of the fellow's name if it comes to me. But anyhow, he had the station, and other hams asked him if they couldn't use this mountaintop station, which they did, and they would extend the range of their 2 meter or VHF equipment by doing that. In California, there's no doubt at all that they really developed this thing. There's an aside story to this. I went out to a convention in Disneyland and gave a lecture on something. But anyway, these guys said, we'd like to show you something. And they had a big rack and panel set up there and they right at the hotel there. And he says, go ahead and call CQ. So I called CQ. This was on FM. And a guy called me, came back, and I gave him a report. And he says, you got a nice signal here in San Francisco. And I says, aren't we on 450 or 2 meters? And he's the guy at first. I said, yeah. And he smiled. And he said, this is a remote base setup where we're linked all the way up the coast to San Francisco. So I was overwhelmed. This was real important to me, you know. It had to be in the very late 50s or very early 60s. And at that time, I was talking on TVI yet even. But anyhow, I came back to headquarters and I went in to see Bud Long and I told him about this. And I said, we're missing the boat if we don't get on the ball on this thing right away. And he said, well, it's up to Tilton. Well, Tilton just kind of shrugged his shoulders and said he wasn't interested. And so we never picked up on it, and we should have at the time. But anyhow, Ed was appointed the first FM and repeater editor. I mean, we had a column in QST just about that and told what was going on. But Ed never pursued it at all. And finally, I'm trying to think of Blakesley. Doug Blakesley was appointed head of that column, but Blakesley was more interested in the purely technical side than the political and the active side of it. Well, anyway, one day, John Huntoon, the general manager of the league, called me in. He said, I want a favor. Would you take over this column? And I said, oh, hell, I got enough to do, you know. But he said, no, at least I'd really like you to. And I was getting up near retirement age and so forth. And I thought, I don't want to get in all the headaches because the politics in this thing were just unbelievable. I know Bill Pasternak was around at the beginning, too, and he could tell you stories of some of the fights that went on. I took over this thing, and I realized right away, because all the fights were going on getting a band plan. And see, until had a band plan that was pretty firm, the manufacturers didn't know whether to crystal up the rigs and set the frequencies. And, of course, if it was one thing I can see, I've always been good at seeing the future and what can come. I realized that we had to have this plan. But we had all these directors in the league from different areas, and they all had different instructions from their people out there. And I'll give you an example. A story, I got so used to it that I just shrugged. I'd go out to California, and they'd say, we know how you clowns do it back on the East Coast, but out here we do it different. I'd go to Texas, and they'd say, we know how you do it up there, but down here we do it different. Go to Michigan, and they'd say, we know how you do it, and we do it different. Everybody did it different than everybody else, and it became very apparent that the only way to resolve this was just to take some kind of a unilateral action and get it done.
You are listening to The Rain Report from www.rainreport.com.
A band plan of 2 meters of 600 kc separation for input and output and the frequencies assignments looked very practical at the time. The New England group had had the plan. The Texas group had had the plan. The Carolina repeater groups had had the plan. California more or less had the plan, but Northern California and Southern California disagreed with each other. They wanted high input or low input and high out and so forth. So anyway, I finally said, oh, to heck with it. And I sat down and I wrote a thing for my column, and I said, here is the ARRL band plan for 2 meters. I took it down to John Huntoon, the general manager, and I said, would you look at this? And I said, do you have any objection? He says, I can't approve this. And he says, what do you want to do with it? I said, I want to take it down and give it to production, put it in a magazine in QST. And he says, well, I can't approve this. He says, the directors would eat us alive. I said, do you object or do you say that I can't put this in the magazine? And he said, no. He says, but you do so at your own risk. So I took it down to production, and Dick Baldwin says, you can't run this. I said, don't tell me what I can't do. I said, I already got an okay from the general manager. So he said, okay. So he ran it. And, of course, the proverbial stuff hit the fan. And the furor only lasted about 60 days. Then all of the manufacturers started making the rigs and crystalling them up. And 2 meters became a huge success. I'm not saying I'm responsible for it, but I was sure one step along the way, I'll tell you that. I left the league, about 1975. I'd had a heart attack from a damn snowstorm back in Connecticut and was determined I was going to get out of there. So I took retirement at 62 from the league, 61 actually, and 32 years. A lot of heartaches, a lot of fun, a lot of laughs, and a lot of good. I mean, and a lot of articles. I mean, I wrote an article. I had to have an article every month, and I retired out of there as a technical editor, so there were four or five of us who were technical editors, so I'd moved up all that way, and quite proud of myself. And it so happened that after I retired, I decided to move out to New Mexico and pick a nice location on top of a mountain, which I have, in a town called Silver City, which is now, other people are discovering it, but it's one of these places that unbelievably low taxes, and New Mexico's got low taxes, and the weather here is just about perfect, you know, year-round. I moved out here, and at that time, Al Dorhofer and Dick Ross bought out CQ Magazine, and I had known the two fellas, and I liked them very much, and they asked me if I'd come with them as their technical editor, so I did. But I live out here, and I write an article for them just about every month, and have traveled for them, and I always go to Dayton every year and that sort of thing. I got interested in QCWA because some of the guys had asked me if I would stand for director. So I became director and then eventually chairman of the finance committee and eventually vice president and then president. I just finished serving a term as president. And I'm still chairman of their finance committee, but we've kind of redone QCWA over those years, and we've got a real fine journal that we have that comes out four times a year. I'm now writing a column in Electric Radio Magazine, reminiscing, just like I'm talking to you here now, some of the stories. As far as the future of ham radio is concerned, I think it will continue. I'm a little worried because I don't believe that they should have international regulations dropping the International Morse Code. And I've got a lot of good reasons for it. I mean, it's traditional and amateur radio is one of the things we use. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of hams who operate CW, and it's their mode. And I just don't see that the league should take it away. I mean, there were several proposals by officers of the league that they were going to dump it. And, of course, QCWA fought this thing, and now they've changed their tune and say that they're going to stand to keep the requirements in for the 10 words a minute. Don't forget, I was hired as a phone man by the league, and I think it's a little surprising when they see me taking this stand to protect code. But we've really got to take a good look at it. And anything that's part of our hobby, I know the Coast Guard's giving it up, and I know that others have, and they talk about the ships. If you've never operated code, I know you have, in fact, I'm sure you have. I mean, because I know it'd be a strong point with you. It's an opportunity to have a different form. It's a fun form of operation. If you've ever operated in any contests or on field day, I mean, you know it's not dead. I mean, my God, you can't even, you have the QRM is tremendous on the guys operating CW. So it's part of our hobby, and I think that we should be tested on it, just like we should be tested on everything in the hobby that's going to be important. My argument is that with ham radio today, we've got so many people that get on, and I even hate to use the term people. I don't know what I would call them, but and I'm sure you're aware of it, like on 80-meter phone and on 20-meter phone, these guys are come on there, and they're self-appointed rulers of everything, and they don't know common courtesy, and I don't know an answer for that. I really believe it's the hams themselves who are to blame for it, for letting it happen. But if you defecate in your own mess kit, it's your own damn fault, in plain English, and I think you'd agree with that. I just feel that we have to try to clean up our own mess here, and we've got a mess. And I have no argument with the no-coders at all. I mean, after all, I was one of the people who sponsored the no-code launch license with QCWA. Harry Daniels, who was one of the president of the time, he and I both felt very strongly there should be an entrance thing for people who didn't want to learn the code, and that would be up in the, you know, in the VHF. I don't think that it's a class that of amateurs that you would have. Well, of course, it's grown, it's very large, but and there's no reason they have to be down on HF. I mean, I can't see the justice in that at all. So I've had some strong arguments about this, and people don't seem to want to see past their nose. At least that's the way I think about it. Maybe I'm just an old-timer, I guess, an old fuddy-duddy. I don't know.
Silent Key, Lou McCoy, W1ICP. He was truly a pioneer in ham radio. This interview was conducted shortly before Lou's 81st birthday in 1997. He became a Silent Key July 31, 2000. 73 Lou, for The Rain Report, I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP.
The Rain Report is copyrighted 2004. Rain, all rights reserved.